When the University of Hawaii named Aaron Gannat as the new head coach for the men's basketball team, many onlookers were surprised. The selection committee picked a 34-year-old first-time head coach to lead the program through troubled times. Aaron Gannat, next on Long Story Short.
One-on-one, engaging conversations with some of Hawaii's most intriguing people. Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox.
Aloha mai kakou. I'm Leslie Wilcox. When you sit down and talk with Aaron Gannat, you don't think investment banker. But Gannat studied economics at one of the most highly regarded liberal arts colleges in the country and had offers he seriously considered. But while he likes business and economics, when he talks about basketball and coaching, he uses words like passion, work ethic, perspective, and balance, values he stresses with his players, whom he refers to as his extended family, values he learned from his own strong family unit, growing up in a blue-collar northern New Jersey community.
Where did you grow up? Where did your earliest formative experiences take place?
Well, I mean, when you're really young, I was born in Philly, grew up in Jersey, so Philly, really too young to remember a lot of the experience there, but moved to Bergenfield, I remember, and then to Tenafly, I think, when I was six, and basically, so those were my formative years.
And what's Tenafly like as a town to live in?
It's a suburbs about 15, 20 minutes from New York City, really kind of a low-key community, really good people, got, you know, one of those communities where everybody kind of knows each other and have been there for a long time, so it was a great place to grow up, you know, an older sister, younger sister, twin brother, great family, friends I got to grow up with from elementary school to junior high to high school. I kind of like that, and I think you can see that even in my coaching career, not really bouncing around too much. So It was a place with a really loving atmosphere, a blue-collar town, but people who really cared about each other.
Both of your parents were immigrants, one from Romania, one from Israel.
So my dad actually was born in Romania and grew up in Brooklyn, and my mom was born and raised in Israel.
And I believe I've heard that three of your grandparents were Holocaust survivors.
Yep. We were born in 1981, and my grandfather, one of my grandfathers on my mom's side, her father, passed that year. So I never had much interaction with him, obviously. And then our other three grandparents were alive, not now, but for most of our upbringing and when we were in Tenafly, and just to hear some of those stories when you're growing up, you remember those.
Any idea about why these three people in your family survived?
The grit and toughness you have to go through that, to one, to survive, and two, the constant fear of what was going on, seeing things happen to your friends and family. I can't imagine it. It's unfathomable, and the atrocities that were going on at that time. But you know, whether you're hearing it from three family members or reading about it or studying it, it's pretty powerful.
You're growing up in this suburb, and but it's not a placid place for you and your brother because you are tough competitors and you're always doing sports.
Well, Pete, you hear stories all the time about siblings battling each other, and think about what it's like for twins. So same year, same teams, you know, we played every sport, and my kids, it added to the competitive spirit and handling, you know, you're going to win or lose every other day in every other sport. And I think our parents did a great job. And, you know, when you're going through just growing up and, like, it's you're competing everything. I talk about that with our team, achievers, you know, on the court, off the court, in the classroom, you know.
You mean you would lose to your brother, you would win over your brother. And so, you know, but the relationship, was that paramount or was it the competition?
Oh, no, when you're younger, it's about the
winning
competition.
Or losing.
Yeah, as you get older, the relationship becomes more important. I mean, I think we pushed each other, obviously, but we competed in everything, not just sports. And our parents were really good about, you know, and we were, I'd like to say coachable, but if we wanted to play sports, and we couldn't do that unless our grades were good. So guess what? If you hear that and you want to go play sports, your grades are going to be pretty good, and you're going to get your homework done.
I mean, you didn't whine and try to get out of it? And have
early,
excuses.
But we weren't going to win that battle.
Your parents were not buying any of that?
No, and they were good on that and created the habits of managing your time, having good priorities. To be honest, I mean, smart wins. Our parents were really good about understanding the big picture.
What sports did you and your twin brother play?
Everything, and then everything changed when we got to high school. So, and we actually went to for 5 years, maybe between ages 10 and 15 or 9 and 14, we went every summer to a sports academy sleepaway camp. So we were set packing, basically, and you play every sport there, So we played everything. And then, you know, the good thing about growing up in the East Coast, you have the seasons.
It snows in New Jersey. What did
you
do then?
2 feet a lot. Well, we played tackle basketball and tackle football in the snow. So, and we shoveled a lot of snow driveways to make some extra money. So, but you knew, you know, the season, in the winter it was basketball, in the spring it was baseball, in the fall it was soccer. And but then when we got to high school, we started to, you know, target. And I encourage that, by the way. I think every kid should play every sport. It tackles different parts of your body. It's different kind of team chemistry. And then you got to find what you gravitate towards. And eventually it became clear when we got to high school, it was basketball.
What about your sisters? Did they play too?
They did. And it's funny, we have a pretty big gap. I mean, my sister was born in 1974. We were born in 81, and my younger sister was 1990. So there was some separation. When we left the house for college at 17, my younger sister was just kind of jumping into sports. So they weren't as sports motivated. They were just as competitive in different ways.
It sounds like it would be hard to be as motivated as you two were in sports, but they were competitive in what ways?
Well, I just think there's some people sometimes think if you play sports, you're competitive. But I think if you're aggressive in the classroom. If you're, you know, those guys, they did a great job. One went to Boston University, one went to American University, and now they're different. You know, one's still in the East Coast, New York. Danielle, my younger sister, Betty's, you know, doing a great job raising her family of three kids in Calabasas. So I just think competitiveness is just the way they attack life. It's not just about basketball and baseball.
But you can overdo competitiveness too, right? Or do you think you can?
No, I think you can. That's why I was talking about the balance. I mean, you have to, you know, I said this about science. Can you find the balance between, I do this a lot with our team, but between working your tail off and compete and enjoying the journey? Does that make sense? And every year, the great things we talk with our staff and people I'm close with, and it's, you're always working on your philosophy, and you can't have one without the other. Life's too short. You can't be good at anything if you're not happy. And you're not going to be happy if you're not doing what you love, where you love, with people you love.
And finding what one loves is often a very difficult thing. A lot of people don't find it for many, many years.
Yeah, and you could see there's stress involved with that. You know, we have guys who come to us at, you know, 18 to 22, and then they leave for, you know, whatever it is next in their, you know, our job is to prepare them for the next step. But I think people rush into things. And look, I was fortunate. I feel like I knew what I wanted to do. And you hear stories about people trying to find that similar passion, but it's got to be natural. It's got to be genuine. Like, my brother is in a different line of work than me. He's in fashion design. He's got his own clothing company, and he didn't really find that till maybe 5 or 8 years, whatever, after I found I wanted to
coach. So you went from being a jock to a fashion designer.
Yes. We're on different spectrums. We're a little different personalities, equally competitive, and obviously similar values.
And he says he's better than you at sports, right?
Yeah, well, he always says, too, you got to respect the older brother. He's 9 minutes older than me. I mean, that's a little out of hand.
Even that's competitive.
No question. But I just think, you know, people shouldn't rush into finding that passion. Like explore. Like, if you have it, great. Chase it. Go through with it. If you don't, find it and take your time. But I think when people rush into doing something, that creates that unhappiness. And you're just not going to be good at anything if you don't find a passion. So if I tell people anything, find your passion and attack it.
Iran Gannat played high school basketball for 4 years and was recruited by Swarthmore, a college outside of Philadelphia. A nagging back injury suffered during his high school career continued to bother him in college. Today he speaks from experience when he warns players about playing through the pain.
And I remember walking into the training room, and my college coach and our trainer were sitting there and going, we think something's going on. And that was the first time I failed the physical because of the back. And he had told me that we met after, and that was a hard time for me. It was actually the only time I missed a practice, I think coaching or playing, because I couldn't practice, and it was too hard for me to go to practice. I couldn't practice in. So
emotionally or
emotionally,
physically?
I just didn't know, you know, I was kind of lost for a stretch there because it was something you're so passionate to take.
And you worked so hard, too. And you loved it so much.
I loved it. Not just the game, being around the team. I mean, I can talk a lot about why I play the game and why I coach the game. But when it happened, it was a difficult time for me, but something that helped me grow as a person. I remember sitting in his office, and he was talking to me. Talking to me as a junior, as much as I love what I do now, but him, my coach, who was great, telling me, hey, maybe we should think about a coaching career. I'm like, wait a minute, I got one more year. So I spent the whole off season doing just getting myself healthy enough to play my senior year. And to be honest, I'm sure our guys will tell you, I have not played basketball since the last game of my senior year. I had to wear a back brace. I wore it under so no one could see that I had to wear a back brace. Think about running around with a back brace. And then my senior year last game, I threw that in the trash, and that's been it for me.
And yet when you went to college, you chose to major in economics.
Yep.
At Swarthmore. That doesn't sound like you're going to be you're planning on playing or coaching.
Yeah, no, I had a background in economics. I really liked business, and I think you can see some of that as I approached running our program. When Swarthmore had recruited me and I had known a little bit about it, it wasn't far from home and it was a really good academic school. I thought in the 1% chance I chose not to chase a path in coaching, I thought I'd be set up in that field. And there were some opportunities, you know, after I graduated, and I was gravitated towards kind of an investment banking background.
And you got a job offer in investment
banking. Yeah, some opportunities after that, but it didn't register or resonate with me as much as what ended up being a volunteer position at St. Mary's. So people thought I was crazy.
Yeah, I would imagine, because it wasn't just a quick stint of volunteering. You volunteered for three years. You didn't get paid, but did you get other perks like meals or housing?
Well, I joke with people that, you know, I was able to work camps every summer. So let's say my first year I made four, and I had saved money in the event I knew I would, if I was going to get an opportunity, it might be something where I'd have to really toughen up for a couple of years to make it work. But really worked hard during that stretch, made some money in camps. Eventually one year I was able to teach a basketball class on the side, and the cafeteria folks, who maybe they felt bad for me, let me come in for some meals and just to make it through. Remember, back then I didn't have a family. I was just, you know, very pleased and appreciative of the opportunity. I was going to do everything I can to hang in. It became tougher each year, especially my third year, but some of the coaches there helped me kind of hang in there, and then eventually got a couple breaks.
Were you hoping every year they'd offer you a paying job?
You know, some places you might have an opportunity to do that. Some places you need some movement. You know, there was a very fixed amount of opportunities or jobs.
And was that the case with St. Mary's?
St. Mary's. So it's funny now looking back, because after I left, eventually there was some movement. But in the meantime, I looked at it as a great apprenticeship for me, learning from a great coach. We worked with some great coaches. I mean, a couple of the coaches I worked with then are now Division I head coaches. And those guys started off as volunteers as well. So I don't know if they did it for 3 years, but it's just the way it played out. And then I got
You were self-financing, too. I mean, that's got to be hard, working extra so that you could work for free.
Yes. And it's weird as it sounds, looking back, and loved every bit of it. You know, the amount I was learning and the what was going on with our program. And, you know, I just think at the end of the day, it satisfies the passion. And one of my other passions is learning and growing, and I was doing that. So the Bay Area was great, and just looking forward to the next break. And then I got my next one with Hawaii.
How did it change?
Well, I got an opportunity with Riley Walsh, and so that was my first part-time paying job. I think it was, at the time, that position, which is now full-time, was a casual hire. I think it was maybe $15,000 or $20,000.
So now you're living in expensive Hawaii,
yeah,
and you're getting paid, but not much.
No, but compared to what it was, I thought I was a millionaire. So, I mean, I go from New Jersey to, and Randy Bennett hires me over the phone. So at St. Mary's. So I just fly over to the Bay, he picks me up. And it's funny, as then 3 years later, I fly over to have a conversation with Coach Wallace, and he picks me up in the airport. So I didn't know, that was 2006. I didn't know it would lead to what it would, but I was excited about the opportunity to work for Coach Wallace, who I had a lot of respect for from afar. I knew there was potential for it to be his last year. So what an opportunity, and a guy who's a huge mentor for me in my life. It's all about timing, but if it was a year later, it might not have happened with Hawaii, and certainly not with Coach Wallace. So I'm very appreciative. I think people should make their decisions, you know, like I told you earlier, about passion, which it was satisfying my passion, but also about people. So I got spoiled. You could get a higher paying job in a better situation maybe with the wrong people. That's why I said you got to do what you love, where you love, with people you love. I got all three. Maybe it didn't satisfy things from a financial standpoint, and I was just trying to hang in. There were some rough days, but I couldn't have asked for a better start, and the people I got to meet and know and learn from, it was awesome.
Iran Ganat spent 4 years on Hawaii's staff under head coaches Riley Wallace and Bob Nash. Then he got the call from his mentor at St. Mary's, Randy Bennett. Ganat would return to the Bay Area and spend the next 4 years as an assistant coach before moving up to associate head coach for the St. Mary's Gales.
12 years of hard work absorbing all he could learn about coaching Division I college basketball. But was Aaron Gannat ready to take on a challenge even the most experienced would avoid? Was he willing to head up a troubled college basketball program that didn't even know yet how much trouble it was in? But even when you got a great opportunity, which was you were offered the head coaching job of the UH basketball team, I mean, it came with a lot of darkness around it. The NCAA violations, you were the third head coach in 2 years,
right.
And there were looming sanctions. And I may be wrong about this, but I thought many of the players really liked the interim coach because he'd been with them through mm-hmm. a lot.
I called it like the perfect storm. First, you wanted to get a crack at getting into coaching and then seeing, can I do this? And then as it became clear and as I got better and better it became clear that, you know, one day you're in this to run your own program. And people always ask me, and I said this at the press conference, your dream job. And I just said, I'm not throwing out, and it goes back to the investment in the sense of family and relationships. I'm not going to throw out random schools. Like, I think your dream job to me was a place I coached or played before. And it became more clear that Hawaii resonated the most with me in my heart. So when it was going through a lot of stuff, that's what I call the perfect storm. There was on-court, off-court, NCAA, everything you could say, and there was a looming cloud of uncertainty. And I'll take, you know, I'm in because there was a pull for me because of what it was going through. So a place I have so much respect for and so much love for, let's get us one, stabilize our program, get us through this, and set us up for sustained success. Hawaii deserves better, and so I was really excited to get that opportunity.
You built relationships with the team members.
I mean, the first thing I did, which goes back to relationships, was there's so much work to do when you get a job, but we made sure, met with the players, traveled to meet with their families, built relationships, didn't skip steps, and went from there.
Fans were thrilled that Gannat, his staff, and that 2015-16 team took the state of Hawaii on an unprecedented ride. A Big West Conference championship earned the Bows an appearance in the postseason tournament of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA. And this fiercely determined group beat a talented Cal Berkeley squad, giving Hawaii men's basketball the first March Madness victory in the history of the program. And the country's president at the time, a risky bracket win in the first round. Aaron Gannat was the third youngest head coach among the 68 head coaches at the tournament. At the end of the season, he was acknowledged with three awards: Big West Conference Coach of the Year, the Red Auerbach College Coach of the Year, and the CollegeInsider.com Joe B. Hall Award for Top First-Year Coach. And then year two comes around, and that's a hard year because then the sanctions take effect, and didn't you lose eight players because one of the sanctions was no postseason?
Yeah, you could write a movie. I mean, it could be a movie. I mean, I think going through it and looking back at it, I'm so appreciative where we're at now. We could easily not be where we're at now if we skipped some steps earlier, which we didn't do, and I'm proud of the players, the staff, the administration, everybody who was involved in this, but usually I'm a guy who likes to read and study and meet with people, and maybe there's experience I have or they have. So what we went through is very unique. Usually when someone gets a ban or NCAA situation, it's for that year. Because of the timing of the decision, it was mid-December, it was for the following year. So they say, who am I going to talk to on that? No one. No one's been through it. So it became a great challenge, an opportunity to see how our team sticks together. But that second year, we returned 1 point per game. So you see a cloud of uncertainty, which is tough to deal with, but the next couple of years, we dealt the reality of the situation. So I think a lot of people talk about that first year's group. I can't say enough or sing enough praises for the people who spent the last 2 years getting us to where we're at today.
Well, that second year, you did lose people, and how did you manage?
Either you hang your head and pout, or you look at it as an opportunity. You talk about what you have or what you don't, what you can do or what you can. And that's kind of been a great lesson for all of us. As much as we, going through that experience, reinforce some things, we learn some new things, but we chipped away. We talked about stabilize. That became the big deal for our program. When you get hired, I know I say this a lot, is you want to build, build, build. When you get the information on what's going on with our program, it became, we got to stabilize and build. We can't build if our program isn't stable. Our program wasn't. So it became chip away. Every year, make sure we're improving. Make sure by 2018-19, no off-court issues, no NCAA issues. Academics in great shape, no NCAA issues. So really proud of the way those guys hung in there together to put us where we're at now. And so how do we do it? It's all about people.
And on your side, you say that it was actually a plus. There are problems here, and you wanted to get to them. It didn't faze you, and in fact, it actually drew you near.
Yeah, no, it was something that I wanted to see us through and beyond. And we brought in, and that's not, I hate to use the word I, because this was a team effort in terms of starting with our administration. It's always about the leadership in place, from the president to our athletic director, the staff we brought in, the people we brought in, our support staff. It was a very much a team effort to get us where we're at today, but there was definitely a pull. At the end of the day, passion is, let's say, basketball specifically, and team and competing, but challenges. You got to love a challenge, and I think a lot of people would look at that and probably did and say, I don't want to be part of this, and we were the other way.
Well, does a team ever really get stable? I mean, what happens in you never know who you're going to have, for sure. I mean, maybe there is no time when a college basketball team is really stable.
Well, that's what you're trying to compete with, or trying to establish a culture and identity. And I would say the culture can get established every year, and I think ours is firmly established. Our program is in a rock-solid position now, but there are certain things that happen. You're dealing with human beings, the obstacles in our business.
And you're always managing around it and navigating around it.
But we're working off a rock-solid foundation now.
You know, I know you met your future wife at the UH, and I've heard her quoted as saying, you know what? He never even dated. He was just too busy. He was always busy. How did that tradition break?
I think when we talk, I should have said this earlier, I have a great family. Obviously, my immediate family, where I grew up, my parents and my siblings, but my wife and daughter are awesome, and the support system there, and hopefully vice versa, I got it pretty good there. Barbie likes to tell the story about she just put it on the calendar. I usually follow a calendar, and then she just said, date with Barbie. And but we connected, and she's got a huge heart, and we share the similar affinity for Hawaii. We got a special young daughter in Ziza who's very, it's cool is that she gets to grow up in a place that we love. And people are watching her grow up right in front of their eyes. And I just think everything's about family, and I got a great one.
Ziza is an especially interesting story because she didn't grow up as either your wife's daughter or your daughter.
Yeah. It was a unique, obviously sad situation. In September 2012, you remember things vividly. I remember being about to walk into a meeting with the team at St. Mary's before workouts, and then I got a call from Barbie's father, who shared the news with me about her daughter, Chelsea, who's off the charts, awesome, who was killed in a car accident. She was pushed into the other side of the road by someone with road rage. And so he shared that with me, and obviously that's a devastating news, but he also shared it with me so I can go home and see Barbie and be there when she heard the news. And and Chelsea's daughter, who was 18 months at the time, was Ziza.
18 months.
Yeah, and so the only fortunate thing in such a tough situation, a really sad situation, is that Ziza wasn't in the car, and so we've raised her since.
Did you have to stop and think about that?
No. I mean, Chelsea would visit here and there, and Ziza was in the baby carriage, and she obviously was as active when you're that young, but you don't expect certain things like that to happen. First it was, let's make sure Barbie and the family are okay, and what can we do? And I remember Barbie bringing that up, or that conversation. It was, hey, let's go, and Ziza's very much our daughter. And she's very, one of the unique things looking back is how, whether it was St. Mary's or here, that people in the community stepped up. She gained, obviously, Barbie and myself, but usually you have 15 or 16 players. She gained 15 brothers, older brothers. And if you come to watch our program now or at a game or at a function or whatever, and this is for my daughter, this is for our coaches' kids, from our assistants, they're immersed with the program. So we have intelligent young men on our team that are highly caring and very much understand the family aspect. Because the Hawaii experience is very unique. And this is the credit to how special Hawaii is. If you can feel like you're at home 5,000 miles from where you grew up, it's pretty special. And when I come in here, I think my first time I came here in 06 as a 24-year-old, lost and confused and just trying to find his way, the great people in Hawaii usually do, they lend a hand. And so it started from there, and that's why I'm so happy to be here now. That's why I'm so happy to have our players here, to have my daughter grow up here. It's special.
When we sat down for this conversation, it was the fall of 2018, and Eran Ganot was looking forward to his fourth season as head coach of UH men's basketball. After three seasons, his teams posted 59 wins and 35 losses, with two out of three winning seasons. UH extended his contract through the 2023 season. And that troubled program mired in controversy stabilized under the leadership of the young first-time head coach, who told us one of the reasons he took the job was because the program was in trouble. We thank Eran Ganot for his time. You'll find more of this conversation in our Long Story Short archives at pbshawaii.org. Mahalo nui for joining us. I'm Leslie Wilcox for Long Story Short and PBS Hawaii. Aloha nui.
For audio and written transcripts of all episodes of Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, visit pbshawaii.org. To download free podcasts of Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, go to the Apple iTunes Store or visit pbshawaii.org.
I was fortunate enough to be involved with Positive Coaches Alliance. We spoke to the parents one day, and they asked me for advice, and I say this to the parent, like, I'll tell the player with the parents there, hey, your job is to, we coach you, we don't coach your parents. There's great communication with us and our parents, but not in terms of the playing time and things like that. For the parents, I advise the group I was speaking to, sit back, relax, and enjoy the game. We have enough coaches. You know, and I think there's a balance there, because I think there's a lot of, they're awesome parents. They want their kids to do so well. We do too. But what's happening is it's a little bit more pressure on the kids, and we got to remind them that we're playing for the love of the game, and that's a critical age where let them struggle through some things, let them, you know, don't let them be accountable, let them fight through moments, fight through adversity, let them have fun. Because and that doesn't change whether you're at that age or for us, because that's something you got to remind yourself of. Is you gotta, like I said, work your tail off and enjoy the journey, have fun, and I think we gotta have that in better balance.